This is Radio Freethinker, episode 102.
Whoever is led to believe that species are mutable will do good service by conscientiously expressing his conviction. For only thus can the load of prejudice by which this subject is overwhelmed be removed.
So what you know about natural selection? Go ahead and ask a question and see where the answer gets you. Try being passive aggressive or try smashing heads in and see which tactic brings your plans to fruition. If you have an explanation in mind, then you're wasting your time, because the best watchmaker is blind. Takes a certain base kind of impatient mind to explain away nature with intelligent design. But the truth shall set you free from those useless superstitious beliefs in a literal Adam and Eve and that Edenic myth, because their family tree is showing some genetic drift. Take it from this bald-headed non-celibate monk with the lyrical equivalent of an elephant's trunk. It's time to elevate your mind state and celebrate your kinship with the primates. The weak and the strong, who got it going on? We lived in the dark for so long. The weak and the strong, Darwin got it going on. Creationism is dead wrong.
The view which most naturalists entertain, namely that each species has been independently created, is erroneous.
Okay, it's time to reveal my identity. I'm the manifestation of tens of millions of centuries of sexual selection. Best believe I'm the best of the best of the best of the best of generations of competitive pressure genetically. But don't get upset, cause we got the same pedigree. You and I will find a common ancestor eventually if we rewind geological time regressively. And I can say the same for this hibiscus tree and this lizard and this flea and this sesame seed. And if you still disbelieve in what your senses perceive.
Hello and welcome to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. And in the studio today, we have a special guest freethinker, Bubba Brinkman.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
Well, you're welcome. And you're hearing a little bit of Bubba's Rap Guide to Evolution, which he'll be performing live on the 20th at the Railway Club. Are you excited, Bubba?
I am excited about that. I've got a lot of friends and family coming to check it out because I've been doing a lot of gigs out of town, and it's the first one I've done at home for quite a while.
Excellent.
Yeah, you know, I hope the people that go to your show, you know, represent your show properly, because recently I've been listening to Skeptoid. And for those people who are in the podosphere, know that Skeptoid is one of the big names in skepticism. And he did a recent review about Scientology, and I was just horrified by what he had done. He sat there and said, well, if you look at their literature and all that, Scientology isn't all that bad, and if people want to be a Scientologist, they should have the right to do all that. And somehow just overlooking all the stuff that they've actually done. I mean, we've covered Scientology on our show before, and I just thought it was just such a horrible job, and it was embarrassing as a skeptic to have listened to what he'd done. And I just, you know, starting my week off listening to that was just a bummer.
Are you going to write in to complain?
No, I'm Canadian. I'm too polite to do that.
Oh.
He's complaining right now.
He's going to complain on a different podcast. That's great.
Yeah.
But speaking of, like, one of the things I bring that up for is the idea of, you know, policing skepticism. And part of that is we want to promote skepticism in all that in the universe, in the world. And one of the people who does that sort of thing in science in general is our guest free thinker. So we have some questions and some comments and some stuff about that. Let's get into it.
Sure, why not? Well, Bubba, why don't you tell us first, how did you get involved in the skeptical rapping? Where did this project come from?
Well, I wouldn't have actually classified it that way when I started out. I was a literature major, and I did rap adaptations of literature. So I did a master's in comparative lit, and then I wrote a Canterbury Tales rap adaptation, and I was touring that around the UK. And then I got a special request from a geneticist who works at the University of Birmingham. His name is Dr. Mark Palin, and he said, I really enjoy your Chaucer rap, which I've seen you perform. Would you be interested in doing a Darwin rap next, as your next project? And he had some funding from the British Council to set up an event on Darwin Day for 2009 for the bicentennial, and he said, you know, I'm organizing a symposium, there's going to be science speakers, and I'd like you for the entertainment. So it was sort of an assignment, and I didn't consider myself an expert or really a skeptic by definition when I was starting at the time. But the challenge that he put to me was, do your homework and make sure that you really understand the theory so that when you're speaking to experts, you're not embarrassing yourself and me in the process. So then I had to send him drafts of the lyrics, and he came back with corrections. And through the 6-month process of researching Darwinian biology for this rap show, I came across all this other stuff, and I basically realized that, you know, I was confident that creationism was wrong, you know, but I was more of a sort of agnostic, like maybe there's something out there type, and you know, had sympathies towards alternative medicine and religion, that I found that if I wanted to take a strong stand against creationism, that the only standard by which you could do that was reason and evidence and the scientific method, and if you stood on that foundation for defending evolution against creationism, then you would be hypocritical to not defend evidence-based medicine against homeopathy and defend, you know, a skeptical worldview against myths and monsters and gods and demons. And so that was my sort of gradual evolutionary process from being a sort of live and let live, everyone can believe what they want type, to being a it's morally important for you to stand up for what's true type. And now I do identify as a skeptic and an atheist, although 2 years ago I probably would have, like, you know, waffled a little bit on both of those terms. So it was really about researching biology, especially because there were things that before I put in the category of, you know, we can't really explain this with science, so maybe there's something out there, until I read about some evolutionary psychology theories of the origins of religion and spirituality as adaptations. And then I was like, oh, well, that explains the things that I personally may have experienced, which I would have attributed to a supernatural force, because I have had experiences, you know, whatever, lucid dreaming type things and psychedelics and things like that, where I was like, you know, that there's no way that's coming from this material reality. But, you know, there's a strong reason why people would hallucinate entities and intentional beings interacting with them in their environment for adaptive reasons. And when I really got into those theories, then I was like, okay, that's it. There's nothing left. I'm a skeptic.
I find it actually quite interesting because you're describing essentially the whole idea of God of the gaps, right? Mm. I mean, everyone says, well, there's these areas you can't explain. But if you do a bit of research or you give it enough time, we tend to fill in all those gaps.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm curious to know which was the bigger divide, because perhaps I'm a bit of a fuddy-duddy when it comes to this sort of thing. Do people still use that word, fuddy-duddy?
Only fuddy-duddies use it.
Which was the bigger gap? Learning yourself up to understand this science, or to get these academics to be really into your rap music? I mean, again, I have this stereotypical view that academics are not exactly your prime audience, but do you find that people take to this naturally, or?
That's an easy question. It was way easier to win over academics than it was to do the research. So they're definitely linked together, but it's not. I mean, I think everyone, whether they're a scientist or a skeptic or a literature person or a scholar, or whatever, tends to be skeptical about what I do, to use another application of the word, because they're like, oh, he's a white rapper that raps about biology and medieval poetry, hey? Sounds great. And there's this sort of like instant assumption that it's going to be a really embarrassing middle-aged white guy that's like, yo, my name is Darwin and I'm here to say, and just got everybody shaking their heads like, get this guy off the stage. And I actually have a lot of fun with that because, you know, not to take on airs, but I think I'm pretty good at rapping. And so I get to like step out in front of a crowd and have them all look at me like with that tension, like this is going to be really embarrassing, and then I get to convert them and bring them around. And I think, you know, if anybody sees me perform, I think, you know, their skepticism about the possibility of an academic white guy from Canada taking on hip-hop music as a medium for expressing complex subjects is not as preposterous as it sounds. And, you know, it's all in the execution.
Well, you see, again, in a way, this whole experience of yours proves the scientific method, because people sit there and they make assumptions and use anecdotal evidence, but you've gone out and you've actually tested and experimented with this actual process, and you've come back with actual empirical data to say, listen, it works.
And I definitely think that the experience of performing for live audiences is very analogous to the hypothesis and disconfirmation process that moves science forward, because every performance is an experiment, and the only thing that you know, that validates it is the audience's response. So there's a whole evolutionary process by which performers learn their craft, and the art form of hip-hop or the art form of cinema or the art form of anything really will evolve. It's in response to audience feedback, like science evolves in response to empirical research.
And so do you look at the Rap Guide to Evolution as sort of educational outreach, or is this more becoming your unique form of art?
Well, I try not to think about those things as exclusive, but I think there is a priority, and it's that it has to be entertaining first.
Right.
And that's actually a Chaucerian principle. I really got that from the Canterbury Tales, where Chaucer's got characters who will really inept, poorly, you know, just useless storytellers, basically, who the audience will respond with hostility to, and then Chaucer will say, "Wherefore thou mayst have noon audience, enforce thee not to speak." You know, the speaker must have a reason to exist beyond their own ego and their own agenda, and that's to entertain a crowd. So if you can entertain a crowd and make them laugh and mesmerize them and take them on a journey, then you can deliver all kinds of interesting messages, and that's the challenge with this, is it's got to be art first. It's got to be a good entertaining performance first, and personally, I'm interested in educational outreach, and the reason I'm interested in what does it take to make people who reject good ideas rethink that so that they can accept good ideas, because I think there's some great ideas out there that don't get as much play as they should, and some really stupid ideas that get way too much play. So, you know, you need a vehicle to deliver it, yeah. And rap is the vehicle for me.
And I think that plays into, I mean, one of the things that's been a reoccurring theme on our show and skeptic community in general is that scientists tend to, in general, focus a lot on the facts and the knowledge and less about the communication of that information to the public. And that's one area where the other side do really, really well. They tend to be very entertaining, which is easy because, I mean, they're dealing with fiction. They can just make shit up and it works.
Oversimplifications that work well as sound bites and fail to take into account reality.
Right, yeah. Absolutely. So who was your initial target audience when you started doing the rap guide?
Well, my initial target audience was a symposium in Birmingham on Darwin's Day. And that, you know, that's what I was really like. I was aiming for that. And I had about 6 months of preparation, and I spent 5 of those months just reading and taking notes and not writing anything. And then when I hit the point of, oh my God, I've only got a month left before my first performance, that's when I started writing the lyrics and revising and trying to get it ready and sending drafts to the professor. So the debut performance was at Cambridge University in the UK at the chemistry lecture hall for about 20 to 25, mostly scientists and science students. But luckily, in that audience was a journalist who wrote for Science, the peer-reviewed journal, and he reviewed the show really well on their website. So then that gave other people a little bit of inspiration to give me a chance. And then I took it to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which is really the testing ground, because there's no... I mean, of course, it's going to draw science people. There's a self-selecting audience because it's got evolution in the title. But on the other hand, lots of random... you know, passerbys, people who just want to go to a comedy show, you know, drunken crowds. Like, you can't make any assumptions of catching a free ride on your material, you know, or the vested interest of someone who's into science. You have to actually put on a really good show there. And so that was about, you know, 6 months after starting the show off. And then from there, it's been a huge variety. High schools, colleges, theater. I performed at Robin Ince's 9 Lessons and Carols for Godless People, sort of comedy variety showcase in December this year and last year. And Dawkins was in that, and Ben Goldacre was in it, and Simon Singh, and Darrell Breen. It's really this is great, like, science and skeptical comedy and music movement in the UK that I haven't found the equivalent for here. I'm starting to, like, search. And when we were putting on the show on Sunday, we were like, okay, we need somebody to open for us with a science theme that's entertaining. It's like, wrong country.
So were you aware then that you had this sort of built-in audience of skeptics who loved this kind of artwork and really embraced it?
Nope. That was actually one of my favorite surprises of doing this project.
Cool.
Is I did it for that one, and Mark Palin said, by the way, it's Darwin's year, not just one day, because of the sesquicentennial of the Origin of Species as well. So go ahead and promote it all through the year and you'll get uptake. And you know, I really did not write this as a show targeted at atheists or skeptics. I just wrote it as the most sort of sensible account of how Darwinian biology works. As it stands, that's actually one of the best arguments for skepticism and atheism, as it turns out, because it's a good explanation for lots of things that are usually attributed to other things. So then I'd get a lot of atheists and skeptics coming through saying, what you're doing is amazing, I really love your show, and I'd be like, oh, who are these people? You know, and that through that whole, there's a whole sort of... you know, movement or community in the UK that's really sort of the science thinkers, science writers, and science comedians, and they basically adopted me, and I just got to meet I got to meet Dawkins, I got to meet Dan Dennett, I got to meet, you know, loads of people at the Cambridge Darwin Festival, and yeah, it just felt like kindred spirits I didn't even know were out there, you know.
Awesome.
Do you find there's a huge or a small difference between, first of all, the skeptic community in England versus Canada versus the other places you've been to, and the non-skeptic people that you talk to in general? Like, and is there playing off one and the other?
Well, I think the skeptic community is far more well-established in Britain. They've got their skeptics in the pub thing pretty much throughout the entire country. But, you know, it's a much less religious country on average. than America, and I would say a less religious country than Canada as well. Only the difference is that in Canada, fewer people identify as religious, but much more identify as not religious but spiritual. And as soon as if you really are going to make a distinction between people who believe in unsubstantiated accounts of the world versus those who look for reason and evidence, you have to put the spiritual people in the religious category. In which case, I'd say Canada is just as religious as America, just with a different choice of religion. Hmm. So and much much less. That's much less the case in Britain.
So how do sort of like non-skeptics, non-science literate people react to your show? Do you ever get like negative feedback, people walking out or anything like that?
Well, I have a question period at the end of quite a few of the shows where people can hit me with whatever they want. And, you know, I've had some creationists for sure. You know, you can't prove that the universe wasn't created at the beginning because you weren't there. And, you know, a lot of it becomes gap stuff or just misinformation about the evidence. You know, there's no transitional fossils, that kind of crap.
Right.
And, you know, the general response from people who are not instinctively hostile to evolution tends to be positive, even if they don't identify as skeptics themselves, you know, because I really did. The show is not, it's not about trying to prove to everybody that their ideas are wrong. You know, it's more about defending the territory of good science and good evidence, and saying there's good evidence for evolution, and not just for physical evolution of our anatomy, but also for our behavior. As I defend evolutionary psychology in the show, although I say I won't defend everything an evolutionary psychologist has tried to claim. But if you don't think our behavior comes from evolution, where do you think it comes from? You know, that's really like what it comes down to for me. And you know, I think I give it to people that if they want to have a place, if they want to compartmentalize, I'm not trying to take away anybody's faith. You know, if they want to have an argument about why they have the faith, I'm happy to have that argument. But I didn't want to make the show be about attacking religion. I wanted it to be about celebrating Darwin and his insight. And and I leave it to people, like, if you want to find a place for your faith that doesn't compete with all of this great evidence that we have for evolution and behavior and all this stuff, then go ahead. But I'm trying to stake out that territory. I'm not trying to like attack and annex other territories.
Cool. What are your thoughts on some of the other artists out there who are sort of using science as their source material? Have you heard of the Symphony of Science songs?
I have, yeah. I've checked a few of those out on YouTube. Is that the one where they sort of auto-tune speeches?
That's right.
Yeah. I saw the Carl Sagan one. I think it's brilliant.
And, you like the auto-tuning?
I don't go for auto-tuning myself. I probably should, because I don't have a great singing voice, and I'm sure it could improve me a lot, but you know, I still have that underground sound.
Right.
But I like the sound of it, yeah.
Cool.
So what about the opposite? What about something like Insane Clown Posse, who, you know, says magnets, that's gotta prove God. You know, I mean, is there a lot of pushback? I mean a lot of artists will be spiritual or be religious, but it's not front and center, but there are a few of them that are coming out to say, this is my shtick, above and beyond gospel, which is a horrible, but
yeah.
They sound good, but
I mean, there's a lot of proselytizing that goes on in rap. I mean, Kanye West, Jesus Walks. And I gotta say, that's a great song. Like, I have that whole, all the lyrics of that song, you know, in my head, and I think it's a really nice piece of music and everything. But you know, I see that as sort of the equivalent of what I'm doing. It wears its agenda quite boldly, you know, and but it's just the opposite agenda. And I've never heard any rap that doesn't self-identify as skeptical rap, putting forward a skeptical message. That's one thing that, you know, but I have heard lots of rap that doesn't self-identify as religious rap, putting forth a religious message. So that sort of sneaks into loads and to the majority of artists' lyrics, unfortunately, I would say, because it just basically means they either haven't put the thought into it or they haven't encountered the evidence.
So what other sort of skeptical issues do you, you know, take to heart? Do you focus a lot on alternative medicine, aside from evolution and religion?
So maybe your next project is going to be like climate change, because there can be a lot of educational opportunities with that particular topic.
Yeah, I mean, that's very high on my agenda. So far, I've done two: the Rap Guide to Evolution and the Rap Guide to Human Nature, and they're sort of like a sequence. So it's like Volume 1 and Volume 2 or whatever. And I have intended to have Volume 3 be the Rap Guide to Religion, because I see that as sort of zeroing in on the most interesting thing about human behavior. I think religion is the most interesting thing, and especially the sort of pure altruism phenomenon that occasionally exists and where that came from. And So, you know, that's possibly going to be the next one. But on the other hand, alternative energy Ballard scientist, engineer at Ballard Fuel Cell Systems recently contacted me and said, I've got a group of climate scientists I've been talking to, and how would you feel about doing the RAP Guide to Climate Change? So, you know, it's tough to say which one's a bigger issue, is it? Because religion, in a lot of cases, is a problem in the context of climate change. Because if people think the world's going to end in the next 100 years, then they don't need to bother recycling or reducing their emissions. I don't know. I'll see which one. I don't know. I guess I'll see which one seems like the best pick.
Well, I noticed there was one thing that I was thinking about this topic that leads one into the other. Because, you know, originally the big debate was evolution, right? But science so shows that evolution is a fact and true. So in order for you to be a creationist or whatever, is you have to be willing to say science is wrong and doesn't work. And once you make that first leap, then it becomes easy to say, well, if they're wrong about evolution, they can be wrong about climate change. Yeah. And how one actually kind of creates the atmosphere for the second, which is why, you know, the anti-climate change thing has been slow to build, but once it's been building, it's gained speed.
And there's a lot of websites that are specifically devoted to denying climate change and evolution together. But I think a lot of people, wouldn't make the argument that science doesn't work. It's more like they actually think it's a conspiracy. Creationism breeds conspiracy theory thinking, because you really have to think that every university at every public institution and every biological scientist in the entire world are colluding to deceive people because of how strongly they're all defending this idea about where life came from. It's such a massive amount of conspiracy that would be required to pull that off, that if you think they could pull that off, then climate change would be an easy job. And 9/11 would be even easier, right? Mm. So then you got no skepticism left, basically.
But you can understand why they're paranoid. They think there's an invisible man watching everything they're doing, judging them, and will one day punish them badly for anything they may have done.
Which, in a way, is the ultimate conspiracy theory.
It is. Let's go to a commercial break. We'll be back with more on Radio Free Thinker and Baba Brinkman.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and The Wallflower Modern Diner.
Pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
Free love on the free love freeway. The love is free and the freeway's long. I've got some hot love on the hot love highway. Ain't going home cause my baby's gone. She's not dead.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, soundtracking your free love on the free love freeway since 1982.
Long time later, see a cowboy crying. Says, hey buddy, what can I do? Says, I lived a good life, about 1,000 women. I said, well, why the tears? He says, cause none of them was you. No, he's looking at a photograph.
Of you?
No, of his girlfriend. The video would have shown that, yeah.
It sounds a bit gay.
It's not gay.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, listeners might remember a couple of weeks ago we talked about a Christian astronomer named Dr. Gaskell, who was denied a job, or so he claimed, because he was a Christian and possibly a creationist at the University of Kentucky. He was interviewed for the job, but a number of his fellow professors were concerned that he was a creationist. They circulated emails and they sent some quotes about books and presentations that Dr. Gaskell gave to his hiring committee, and they said, "No, we're not going to pick up this guy. Too risky." So he sued the university for discrimination. And that's where we sort of left things off last time. And now the ruling has come down. The university has reached a $125,000 settlement with Gasco last month in exchange for dropping the civil action. He said professors who discussed his employment misunderstood his faith and his views on evolution and these inter-office emails. And that all came out in court evidence. Gasco went on to say that the divide between faith and science is an illusion. He said he considers himself a theistic evolutionist. He is a Christian who accepts Darwin's theory along with evidence that the Earth is billions of years old. Now, we got a little quote here. We believe that God has done things through the mechanisms he's revealing to us through science, he says. That evolution theory has significant scientific problems and includes unwarranted atheistic assumptions and extrapolations, whatever. I can't say that word. How about that? The question some people ask me is, if I were a biologist and if I didn't have major doubts about the theory of evolution, would that disqualify me from being a biologist? And his response is, no, it wouldn't. So there seems to be some disagreement between Dr. Gaskell and the main stray of skeptical thinking that, in fact, he would be disqualified if he had those major doubts about evolution and he was a biologist. After all, in this case, he's not. He's an astronomer. Eugenie Scott, the director of the National Center for Science Education, said that you can't discriminate based on religion, but you can discriminate based on scientific views. It's perfectly legitimate to discriminate against a candidate based on whether they accept evolutionary theory. Dawkins, not surprisingly, ruled that even if a doctor's belief in the stork theory of reproduction is technically irrelevant to his competence as an eye surgeon, it tells you something about him as a scientist. So the ruling has come down. Discrimination is the word at the end of the day, and he's been paid off. He's probably got some other job somewhere lined up. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I know, when we did this the first time, right, I kind of said kind of opposite with Dawkins, right? It doesn't deal with his core competency, and that we have to be careful that when we judge these things, it doesn't become a witch hunt, because even though I may be well on board with preventing creationists from being in universities, there is the possibility, and I hate to bring up this word, slippery slope, that maybe they won't let communists teach in universities because, they don't agree with that particular aspect of it. Now, I think this has a whole different light because it's dealing with the truth versus not the truth, and it does, I like that idea, it leads you into the competency of his thinking in general, but maybe we should have an expert on evolution and such in our studios.
Well, interestingly enough, that theistic evolution position that he's defending is exactly the same view as Francis Collins, who worked on the Human Genome Project and is now the head of some major health body, which I can't remember the name of, but when he was appointed by Obama, a lot of scientists says he's an evangelical. He should not be in charge of health policy or anything biology related. And he also argues that that evolution and science reveal the mechanistic process by which God's intention is being revealed. And the real question is whether you think there's any intervention going on or not. And if you don't think that there is, then really what you believe is outside of the system should not be relevant. If you believe that a deistic God set the process in motion, biologist at all. But what this guy says is that there's serious problems with the theory of evolution, which can only be a religious perspective and, does seem to compromise his judgment. Although what he also says is there's atheistic assumptions and extrapolations, which I think what he's actually arguing is a disturbing number of biologists turn out to be atheists, and that's a problem. That's not actually a problem with the theory, is it? It's just guilty by association and the worry that evolution is promoting atheism. But the question is really whether he thinks the problems with the theory are with the theory of themselves. If there's actually something wrong with the mechanistic explanation for biodiversity and adaptation, or you need some more sort of divine addition to the mix to explain it, or whether his main problem is not with the theory of evolution, but just with the beliefs of the people who are representing it.
Well, then also is a fundamental confusion between the idea of causation and correlation. I mean, there are a great number of socialists who happen to be poor people. And if you think that socialism causes poverty, you'd go, no, wait a minute, first of all, you haven't said that they're actually related, they just happen to coincide. And the same thing with atheism and biology, that there's a connection.
Although I think Dawkins has made a fairly good argument for the causal relationship between a full understanding of evolution and a loss of faith. I mean, you really can't deny that, because without evolution as an explanatory mechanism, faith almost becomes the most sensible position. It was the deistic position of everyone, even the more skeptical people, up until Darwin. And as soon as we had Darwin, then it was like, oh, there's no work left for God to do, therefore what's the point in believing in it? It seems sillier once you can see the entire world as the product of natural forces, which you couldn't before Darwin. So, you know, a lot of Americans tend to take that position, like, oh, there's no real problem between faith and science, and you can believe in evolution and also you believe in God, sure, but it changes what your conception of what God's job is or what his influence was in the world, basically like massively hobbling it and diminishing it into something that's virtually irrelevant anyway.
Yeah. I think one of the issues, again, with the University of Kentucky is that down the road is the Creation Museum, which I think some listeners know is also expanding. They're building a giant ark. A giant ark.
Well, actually, they're building a life-size ark, so they say.
Yeah.
They're going to follow all the cubit measurements that are described in Genesis and recreate it so people can walk through and see what the ark was really like.
You know, actually, but that could be a good thing, because again, now you can have empirical evidence that not two of every animal on the earth can fit in one of those. I mean, not that it shouldn't be obvious in itself.
Well, they probably say that there were, like, tugboats that were attached to it or something, and, like, the dangerous animals had their own stuff.
They can't cheat like that. If those tugboats were explained in the Bible, then they could add them. And what the real challenge they're going to have is they're going to have to go on Wikipedia and search biodiversity and realize that there are, you know, tens of millions of species, and then try to think about how you could fit tens of millions of species onto any physical structure that would float.
Well, right. No, then they'll misinterpret something like string theory and say, oh, there are multiple dimensions. That's it. We hid them in a pocket universe, like the TARDIS.
They might do what some young Earth creationists do, is come back to the idea of kinds, and all of the species today have diversified from an original set number of kinds, originally created by God in their sort of archetypal forms, and so you do get all the different beak species. So a species of finches with the different beaks on Galapagos having descended from one, but you'll never get a bird from a lizard or a human from a primate. That's a lot of creationists do fall back on that theory, but you end up with a 6,000-year-old Earth, which is against everything.
Well, right. And even then, it becomes incredibly arbitrary as to what is a kind. Right? Because you just said, well, humans can't come from apes. Well, if a bird, like a crow and a pelican, are the same, then how do you delineate between a great ape and a human? And, you know.
It would probably correlate pretty closely to genuses, I guess.
Which they're not.
I've never heard a coherent explanation of that, but I've heard a few people try.
I think we're giving them too much intellectual credit right now.
Yes.
But speaking of sort of religion and society and accommodation, Don, what else is going on in that world?
Well, you know, the big topic... Sorry, I have to switch my pages and my papers. So, recently I've been following quite a number of stories about the idea of accommodation, in particular religion, or if you want to be more politically correct, cultural accommodation. When I first saw these stories, I kind of saw them as great examples, separate, but great examples of how dogma, both religious and secular, can take small incidences and kind of blow them out of proportion. However, after doing a bit of research into them, I noticed there were sort of connections. So my first thought was that, you know, of course, this raises the standard debate of multiculturalism in our society. And I think that's a valid issue for discussion, but something we can focus our skeptic eye on more in the future. However, there was another thread that's been weaved through all these, and this is the idea of accommodationalism. Now, as a Dawkian atheist, I think that religion is innately bad for society. However, I also acknowledge that, you know, the suppression of freedom, and that if the state dictates everything you do in your life, it's also innately bad. So somehow, you know, you had to find some way to split these two, and it inspired me to do a bit more research into this whole topic. Now, the stories that inspired this segment is about the Sikh kirpan, that's a ceremonial dagger, and the Islamic hijab or nijab, and I'll switch those two words between each other. One is sort of the head scarf that covers the whole face, and one is just a veil. Actually, I even wanted to include Mormon polygamy in this, but we've covered that one sort of to death in a previous episode, but it's worth going back just to get a different thing. So on February 9th of this year, the Quebec Parliament officially banned the kirpan from the provincial legislature. This was a culmination of several weeks of controversy over the claimed right of Sikhs to wear a religiously required ceremonial dagger while addressing the legislature. So here's that story. A group of four Sikhs representing the World Sikh Organization were scheduled to make a presentation at the Quebec's National Assembly on Bill 94. This bill itself is quite controversial and was being reviewed in an effort to... to find a reasonable accommodation for religion and cultural practices of minorities in Quebec civil society. This delegation of Sikhs were, ironically enough, denied entry into the legislature when they refused to remove their kirpans. According to security services, quote, this decision was taken by the security services solely for a security reason. The guards offered to offer the option of taking the kirpans, put them in a safe place, and they refused, so they were denied entry. One of the members of the delegation, Belpreet Singh, said, we weren't allowed to enter because we were in our kirpan, which is a bit ironic because we were there to speak upon an issue of an accommodation and we weren't accommodated. Now, the Bloc Québécois wasted no time in raising this issue. It stated that it thought the decision was well-founded and it was time that we brought this sort of thing to the National Parliament. Conservative MP Navib Debains accused the Bloc of being politicking, which of course they were. He says, I've been wearing the kirpan in Parliament since 2004 and it didn't bother them then. Ironically enough, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously in 2006 that a total ban on the kirpan in Quebec schools violated their rights of charter, their charter rights. However, they did say that some accommodation should be made for public safety. Okay, so I've talked about this thing, a kirpan. A lot may or may not know what a kirpan is. A kirpan is both a defensive weapon and a symbol. Physically, it's an instrument of aizma, or nonviolence. The principle of this is to actively prevent violence, not simply to stand idly by while violence is being done. And to that end, the kirpan is supposed to be a tool used to prevent violence being done to a defenseless person when all other means have failed.
Symbolic. That's like the same rationale behind having guns in America.
Largely. And actually, most Sikhs say, well, yeah, we don't do that anymore. They rely on the symbolic meaning. And the symbolic meaning is the kirpan represents the power of truth to cut through untruth. And they have a religious text that sort of defines the kirpan. It's called the Ret Marada, which, of course, I'm probably butchering. My apologies. But it doesn't actually specify the length or the construction of the kirpan or even how or where it's supposed to be worn on the body. So one of the things that Bill 94 was supposed to do was to regulate the kirpans, and as I mentioned, they sort of did it. But one of the MNAs, Louise Boudron, said something I thought kind of encapsulated my thinking on this, that it may be a religious choice that they're willing to make, but it's not a choice that everyone should have to accept. And therein, I think, lies the rub. One of the reasons people adopt religious customs is to show their commitment and their willingness to sacrifice for their beliefs. And that's largely their right. I'm not going to go into that issue. However, at what point does their choices begin to infringe upon me? Now, the first thing being, of course, is we're talking here about a dangerous weapon. And I fail to, you know, they may be willing to live with this, but I don't see why I should necessarily have to. I mean, if I used guns, if I had a gun, there are lots of restrictions placed on where and how I can use a gun. And if I can suddenly use the specter of religion to give myself sort of special rights, that just struck me as sort of a dangerous path to go down.
Well, there's also the whole issue that they're never going to use this knife for violence, but it doesn't stop somebody from grabbing it off them and stabbing someone else. Anytime you bring a weapon into an environment, there's a certain amount of responsibility that you have to keep it from being used. And I don't know if there's ever been a case where someone has been injured by one of these weapons in any situation. I'm sure if that happened, we'd suddenly have a whole new dimension to this conversation. But, you know, there is a certain, I think, onus on them to justify this weapon is not going to be used ever.
Well, and that's the thing. And, I mean, you know, it's this idea, once you flash the religion word, suddenly you get a whole new set of rules, and that part kind of gets me. But there was another aspect to it too that I thought was interesting, is that it doesn't really need to be that big of an issue in a way, because as I mentioned before, there are no written in stone rules as to what the kirpan actually has to be. So it could be a harmless 3 centimeters big, or it could be encased in resin, in which case it still has its symbolic meaning, but it is no longer actually, you know, a potential weapon.
Have you come across the Sikh response to the encased in resin thing? Because I think it's a very good idea. Either that, or soldered into its sheath, or maybe even just make it out of plastic. I mean, either it's ceremonial or it's not. And if it's not ceremonial, it needs to be steel, but then that argument disappears, right?
Exactly. And another thing I thought, too, when I was going through this, is, I mean, one aspect of these religious practices is the idea of sacrifice, right? I mean, they've chosen this path, and they said they're willing to accept the sacrifices for this choice. So that means they have to accept the limitations that their decisions play into it. And if they sort of rework the world so that there is no sacrifice involved, then doesn't that sort of defeat the whole sacrifice aspect of it? Doesn't this defeat the whole point of it? So really, in this particular instance, in this case, I don't think really there should be an accommodation made, at least in the specific sense that we were talking about.
Interesting. Well, let's go to a commercial break on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with a bit more on religious accommodation.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in 5 words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
The 2011 edition of the Homelessness Marathon, broadcasting live from community radio stations across the country this February 23rd, 2011.
We're in a democratic society in Canada and in the States. We're supposed to be so much better than the rest of the world, yet the way we treat our poor may be the worst. The
marathon will be broadcasting live from over 40 community radio stations across Canada.
I speak as a person who was homeless at 16 years old. I speak as a woman at 61 who has in my heart the greatest compassion and love for those who are without a home. So I call upon every person who hears my voice to become committed to creating a home.
If you'd like more information on how you can get involved, please check out ckut.ca/homeless. That's February 23rd, 2011, live from coast to coast and from the streets.
We're back on Radio Free Thinker on CITR. So, Don, you're telling us about religious accommodation. Now we're going to be talking about another instance,
yes,
in Quebec.
Well, you know, this last story about the kirpan leads me into another one, also focused on Bill 94. The heart of this bill would deny government services to those who cover their face with the nijab or hijab. About a year ago, Nama Atef Amid filed a complaint with the province's Human Rights Commission about her experience at a government-funded language class for new immigrants in Montreal. The school, apparently, insisted that to learn French, the instructor must be able to see the student's face. When Amid refused to take off her veil, she was kicked out of her class. Now, this is another example where someone should be willing, at least on the surface, to accept the sacrifices of the beliefs that she's taken on. However, in this case, I'm willing to say that an accommodation might be appropriate. This case differs in two ways from the first one. First, whether or not she wears the hijab, I don't see how that can affect my life at all. It's her choice, and although there are other issues involved, whether she really had the choice, on the surface, we can say it was her choice. The second one is the fact that she is kind of willing to do a sacrifice. I mean, if she wears this mask, and let's assume the school isn't being vindictive and that it will hamper her ability to learn French, she's willing to say, well, it's going to be tougher for me to learn this, and I'm willing to sort of make that sort of aspect of sacrifice. And for some reason, I don't quite see how wearing a piece of cloth, be it a Catholic habit, a hijab, or a hockey mask, should somehow preclude someone from accessing government services. I mean, that's where I think, as much as a rabid atheist as I am, it's taking that one step beyond what I'm actually comfortable with. So, yeah, because Bill 94 basically states that, you know, anyone can be denied services if they do not remove their veil. And I think this is a form of secularist or at least xenophobic dogma. And therefore, in that case, Bill 94 is wrong and accommodation should be made. But I've tricked you all. Ha-ha. That there are sort of limits to this whole class of accommodation. Because I've only told you part of the Mead story. She was not actually expelled for just not revealing her face. The school could actually live with that. However, she did insist that she be sit in a special part of the classroom, sort of isolated from the rest of them, because she was worried of the possible gazes of three men who happened to also be in the class. She apparently did agree at one point to remove her veil in private with a female instructor, but backed out of this compromise when no assurance could be made that a female instructor could be provided for future lessons. She refused to partake in round table exercises because she could not tolerate any of the men seeing her eyes. So, I don't know, it seems like Amid is sort of, this continued for many months. I mean, they tried for about 3 out of the 4 months of the class, and eventually it was so disruptive to the other students in the class, that's when they finally said, no, you have to leave, we can't have you in this class. And I think what Amid sort of failed to understand, that accommodation is a two-way street, that it works both ways, that, okay, maybe we need to accommodate some of the wackier ideas that come out of some people, but then you have to sort of accommodate us. Knowing the complete story, this particular law in this particular instance is quite popular in Quebec, including quite a few noteworthy people in particular. Constitutional lawyer Julius Gray, who defended the rights of inmates to smoke in prison, not that I think that's a great right to promote, but hey, and the right of Sikh students to wear ceremonial daggers, which we've already mentioned on the show, he says that accommodation should not lead to separation. Yolanda Gada, an Egyptian-born writer, makes there's no possible compromise with people with such an inflexible attitude. And Rahid Razi, a Pakistani-born Muslim women's rights activist, says, we come to Canada, we don't come to the Islamic Republic of Canada, which I think is starting to border on the xenophobic, but it gets sort of the point across.
Well, I mean, maybe I'm generalizing a little bit, but hasn't Quebec traditionally been far more hardline when it comes to cultural icons like this and the rest of Canada anyway?
It is much more. In fact, one of the things that I had planned to say for the multiculturalism discussion that we may have in the future is the PQ critic on culture in Quebec said that Quebec is not a multicultural society. Canada may be, but we're not. And if you want any proof, look at the provincial Liberal Party, which supported this Bill 94 and the ban on the Kirpan. So they're saying, you know, Quebec may be in Canada, but they're pointing it's not part of Canada. Now, I'm going to point out these are the separatists. They're going to push that issue. But yeah, no, it does tend to be much more hardline than that. But I think it points to the idea that with the idea of accommodationalism, right, is that, you know, there are certain points where accommodation is right, but it's just not a blanket thing, and there are no get out of sacrifice free cards sort of thing.
Well, I think we're also there's two actual points to this. There's sort of accommodation on a moral ground, which we've sort of talking about, but also accommodation on a practical level. If accommodation requires you to have a whole new class for the student with a female teacher, no men around, and, you know, all these added features so that she can learn French, that's starting to tax a system that just can't support that level of accommodation. And at that point, you know, I think the onus is on the student to find an institution that can accommodate her to that level.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think another aspect to this, which I just totally forgot.
Oh, okay. Well, Baba, what do you think? Any ideas on this?
Well, I did have an interesting conversation with a Muslim woman in London who was an anti-hijab activist. And she said there's nothing about this in the Quran that's substantiated. There's nothing about this that's essential to Muslim culture. It's a extreme fringe that is, you know, personally embarrassing to me as a Muslim, and it's something we're trying to reform from within, and the accommodationism is really not helping us at all. And the future that she was trying to work towards was not one where Islam was, you know, eradicated or anything. She was totally not an atheist, but she was saying, you know, the modernization process of my culture requires that this isn't forced on women. But and it's usually, you know, when I say forced on, it's like it is a choice, but to make a different choice would cause them to isolate themselves and alienate themselves from their close family and relatives and husband. And, you know, it's a choice that's sort of a, you know, if you want to keep your cultural honor with your with all of these ties, then you have to exist in submission in that way.
Yeah.
And, I think that's another thing to take into account is having her in the class with the thing on, realizing that having someone look you in the eyes is not actually as big of a crisis as you might have been brought up to think, that it's a short step from there to just wearing, you know, your hair covered and having your face exposed. It's a short step from there to being able to wear whatever you want. Whereas if you crack down too hard, you can actually radicalize people as well. So I think that's where I see accommodationism as being a benefit, is in the gradual steps towards reform rather than completely marginalizing and polarizing the issue. But, you know, if you're accommodating, I agree, if you're accommodating everything, you know, it sort of ends up being a standstill.
Well, that's the thing. There's not really a black or white to a lot of these issues. But at the same time, you can take sort of a rationalist approach to it. Even if there is no, I mean, that's one of the things we try and promote, is that, you know, science, it's easy to kind of come up with some black and white issues. But you can do that with the social and cultural issues, too. Ironically enough, one of the quotes I was going to use for the segment, I guess I'm going to use it anyhow, was in 2008, the leading cleric in Egypt said that, you know, hijabs and the garb shouldn't be worn by students or teachers at their university. And actually, the Egyptian, because if anyone's watched the news recently, Egypt, exactly, the government that did that is no longer around, and it's been they didn't accommodate the dictatorship that was in there before.
I see. Well, you know what? We're actually running out of time here on Radio Free Thinker. We should go to our skeptical highlights. The first one that we should mention is Baba Brickman is doing the Rap Guide to Evolution, February 20th, 9 p.m., Railway Club, presentation by Radio Free Thinker, CITR, and CFI Vancouver. Tickets are $8 at the door. The evening will also feature the band Era Nazril and the Boom Booms. Baba, what can we expect from this show?
Well, it's the Rap Guide to Evolution is the show I did at the Edinburgh Fringe, and it's going to be transferring to New York in April or May, and it'll be a full off-Broadway show then. So it's, you know, it's a tour of evolutionary theory. I take you through sexual selection, artificial selection, kin selection, group selection, a lot of the controversies around evolution, and also just relate it to human behavior and culture, specifically hip-hop culture. So it's not just rapping about evolution, as in a Rap Guide to Evolution, it's also an evolutionary guide to rap, and why it is the way it is, and helping you understand certain, you know, phenomenon in human behavior that's displayed in rap music. Like, for instance, bling, peacock's tails, basically all you need to understand where bling comes from.
Excellent. No.
Sorry, but, just to put you on the spot again, one of the things we talked about is the growth of creationism in that in the Islamic world. Have you ever thought of translating this particular rap work as appropriate as it could be, to other languages to see if that would ever work.
Well, I have met a few Arabic rappers. I did a tour last year that took me to Egypt and to the West Bank in Palestine, and got to interact with some hip-hop artists who rapped in Arabic, but I didn't get a chance to really to really probe them on their philosophical and scientific beliefs. So, you know, I'm not sure if I know of one who would be on board with the whole project metaphysically, but I think it's a great idea.
Cool. So one final skeptical highlight. Skeptics in the Pub in Richmond is on February 20th, or 24th, sorry, 7:30, Legends Pub, which is only a few minutes away from the Breakhouse SkyTrain station, so come on by for that. Any other skeptical highlights, Don? No? All right. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Baba Brinkman saying stay tuned. It's a great show.
Thanks, Baba.
The 2011 edition of the Homelessness Marathon, broadcasting live from community radio station.